We're at the Cincinnati Old Time Radio Convention, and our special guest is a very talented lady who wrote and performed and just delighted audiences for so many years during the great days of radio and after. She's Peg Lynch, and I'm happy to be here with you today.
Thank you, Jack.
You started in radio back in...
The dark ages.
In the dark ages? No. Station KATE.
Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota. And I'd just gotten out of college. I was 20. And Minnesota. And I got a job. My mother's a nurse at the Mayo Clinic. And I worked there for a while, but I got every disease the clinic had to offer. I thought I better get up. Writers are all hypochondriacs, you know. They got everything. And I got a job. Somebody said, one of the desk girls said, my boyfriend just quit over it. Alberta, Minnesota, and they're looking for a copywriter. Well, I really have never written copy, but after all, you've listened to a million commercials, you get some rough idea, especially since I like writing, and it does them. So I worked over there. I started over there. I wasn't there very long, and I think my pay was something like, I can't even remember, $60 a month or something like that. And I wrote all the copy at the station. I wrote a half-hour show on Sunday, wrote a half-hour woman's show 6 days a week, I got very bored with writing copy, and I do remember one of the commercials. This is now 1930. We're talking 1938. And one of the shoe store, and their slogan was, "Don't spend your life 2 feet away from happiness." And
that
I got
wasn't
really
your
bored.
Slogan, was it?
No, no, not at all. And it was a charming, beautiful little station built by the mayor of the town. And the man who had a furniture store below, and they knew nothing about running a radio station, eventually lost it because they didn't send bills to the sponsors. And I was knocking myself out running to the department store and a little dress shop and everything to get copy for the next day. And finally the receptionist said, "What are you bothering for? They don't pay their bills anyway." She said, "They don't pay anything for it." I said, "What do you mean they don't pay for being on the air?" She said, "No, you know." She said, "Mr. Hike is mayor of the city and he wants their vote. So he never charged people or given them such a bargain." And they lost the thing eventually. And I quit. I asked him for a $5 a month raise. That was it. He came to see me when I was on the air on the network on ABC 10 years later. I don't know. Maybe it was 8 years. It doesn't matter. And he came up to my studio in the RCA building and he asked to take me out to dinner, and we went. And he said, "How did I ever let you go?" And I said, "Mr. Hike, I asked you for a $5 a month raise and you refused me, and I gave you a month's notice." How naive can you be? And from then I went on to Charlottesville, Virginia, and I was there for 9 months, and then up to Cumberland, Maryland, I was there for 3 years. And I did approximately the same thing. I started Ethel and Albert in Albert Lee because it was really boring writing copy all the time. And so I started writing a husband and wife thing. I think I told Goodman Ace, remember Easy Aces?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
I met him years later. And I told him, I said, "I think you sort of inspired, I like the husband and wife thing. Although I grew up without a man in the household. My father died of the flu during the World War, after World War II, and I had no brothers, just mother. And so I really didn't have anything to base it on. And I didn't get married until 48. So I wrote husband and wife about 10 years before I got married, but I don't have any idea what it was. I think maybe I'm Ethel and my mother's Albert. I have no idea. Psychologically figuring it out. People come up like last night after the show. Writers, five people who want to write came up to me last night just in the space of half an hour. And you really can't teach anybody writing. It evolves yourself, and you realize it later. You don't realize it at the time. But I know I didn't. I tried to be funny, terribly funny, and think of something really crazy. And I think at the very beginning, if Ethel saw a grand piano on sale, then I'd have her buy another one because it was really such a bargain. Dumb stuff like that. And it wasn't really until I was in Cumberland, maybe 2 or 3 years later, and I got some fan mail which was like, I was probably two letters, but let's hope say it was six. Uh-huh. And I was so overwhelmed by this fan mail. And I realized then that I had, I got the fan and something that had happened to me. And it dawned on me, I didn't have to try to make up something funny. Mm-hmm. Every single day something
That's
happens
right,
that
yeah.
is not funny at the time, but you can make dinner table conversation out of it. You know, your argument you have with your husband, for example, or your wife as to which side of the mm-hmm. restaurant
yes.
which side of the street mm-hmm. the restaurant was on in your honeymoon, and or what this looked like. Alan had a funny Alan Bunce, whom I later worked
yes.
with in New York. And I always loved a thing that he... I got many, many scripts from Alan and his family. Everything I've written has been based on somebody's experience, mostly mm-hmm. mine or mm-hmm. Alan's or some friend. Or a lot of fans would write in, tell me some of this happened. And then I began to get mail when I got up here. Richard Widmark was my first Albert. He lasted for 6 months and went into a play. That's when I got Alan. And Alan came home on the commuter train to Stamford, Connecticut from mm-hmm. New York, and he met this, he said, oh, hi, Bill, and this fellow that he met, and they chatted all the way out to Stamford. Somebody had told Alan once that if you use, people like to hear their names, mm-hmm. so he was all saying, yes, Bill, well, I think you're right about that. Yeah, I think we've had lousy weather, Bill, Bill this and Bill that, and he got off and he was driving home, and he thought, why, that fellow's name isn't Bill. Good Lord, it's Don. Oh, God, what is the matter with me? Well, he fussed about this all the way home, and it was their anniversary on top of everything. And Ruth had made a nice dinner, and she had little boxes, you know, tied with pretty bows and everything at the table. And Alan couldn't think about anything with it. This is ridiculous, he said. Ruth said, well, I got a little something, you know, a little box there in front of your water glass. He'd say, oh, yeah, and he'd take it, he'd pull open the bone, he'd open it. And he said, I just don't understand it. I mean, we've been to their house, they've been to our house. Why did I get his name wrong? It's just, oh, honey, isn't that sweet? Oh, what a lovely idea. Yeah, you know, I mean, when I got off the train, I said, why did I get his name wrong? Well, she was so annoyed with him. And he was so put out and done this whole thing. And she said, and I've got a real surprise for you. I got two scripts out of it. She said, and he said, what is it? And she said, your favorite dessert, bread pudding. And Alan slammed his napkin down, and he said, I've got to say something. Of course, he would never in ordinary circumstances have done this, but he was so, at this whole thing. So annoyed with himself. And he said, I've got to say something. He said, I'm sorry, dear. I'm really sorry, sweetheart, to tell you this, but I hate bread pudding. She said, why, I've been making this for you ever since we've been married. He said, I know it, and I hate every one of them. She said, well, you said you just loved it. That Dutch laugh. So even after dinner, then, of course, he was eating humble pie, and I'm sorry, I'll eat it, and it's not bad at all, and this is really good, and so forth, trying to clean up his act. So then at the end of the meal, and he still goes back to the, after all this, he goes sitting in the, by the fire in the den, he's saying, well, I don't understand it at all. They've been to our house several times, and we've been to their house, I don't see. And she said, I'm tired of hearing this. If you feel that badly about it, why don't you call him up? And he said, call him up? What would I say? Well, you explain. Be funny about it. Well, what do I say to be funny about? I don't know. You'll think of something. Just get him on the phone and you'll be funny. So Alan called up this guy. This guy he called Bill, and his really name Don was it. Called him up and he said, hi, this is Alan Bunce. And the guy said, Jenny, yelling at his wife, Jenny, that was Alan Bunce I saw on the train. God, he said, I couldn't think of your name at all. And Alan was so mad he didn't sleep all night. I love that one.
Well, so every place, everything that happens is material for you.
If I had come to this convention, this is an mm-hmm. all-time radio convention, mm-hmm. I would probably get 10 scripts out of this, meeting people and things that mm-hmm. they said and things that they've done. And you can always, you're never out of an idea. You going to be here tonight?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Getting dressed. So tonight I've got a script on which they're waiting for somebody to pick them up to go out to dinner. And the couple have said, you decide where to go. Because Chuck and I have such a fight can't decide, and we're, by the time we pick one, we're not speaking by the time we get to the restaurant. So we're picking where we want to go. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to go to Joe's Steakhouse because of the butcher block tables and it's noisy and the bright lights and no atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And he said the food's good. She doesn't like all the food hanging in the front window, you know, these sides of beef that take your appetite away. And she would really like to go to Patricia's Candlelight Cottage, which has, you know, the sweet breads on toast points and all that. So the decision, you want to eat Indonesian or Indian or fish or steak, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then after they've waited, I shouldn't spoil it for you. After they've waited now, it's nearly an hour, and he's really fit to be tied. And they're looking out the occasion, you know, these people who keep other people waiting waste your time. You're doing there, you're not getting anything done. You're just sitting, pacing the floor, looking out the window, waiting for the car to stop and honk and so forth. And she said, well, what do you want to do? There's a pile of magazines on the windowsill. Would you like to look them over and see which ones you've read? And I can throw them in. No, I don't want to look the magazines over. Do you want to fix the doorknob on the hall closet? I'll get a screwdriver. No, don't sit still. I don't want to fix this. Get a screwdriver. And then they discuss the spot on the ceiling. And she says, gee, I didn't notice that before. Something should be done. It wasn't too bad. And you remember when our bathtub overflowed? And he said, well, we fixed that. And he said, well, we can touch that spot up. And they're just making conversation. And he says, well, you can't always touch a spot up. The paint doesn't match. And she says, who's going to look at the ceiling? Well, anybody who walks in, you know, he said, who walks into our living room that looks up at the ceiling? Well, anybody's lying on the floor can see the spot. He said, well, who do we know comes in and lies on the floor and looks up at the ceiling? You know, you're making conversation, and then you're getting madder while you're doing it. Mike Morris said that it's absolutely true, and I didn't realize it. I write completely about life's frustrations. Yes, getting up in the morning, and you think, and you plan to go to the, to do some shopping, and then you think, no, I don't think I'll do that. No, I think maybe I better go, you know, do the ironing this morning, and then maybe get in the store this afternoon. Maybe I should go tomorrow. It's decisions. Mm-hmm. It's the frustrations that I write about, I think, and making decisions that come up all the time.
Well, you have the
ability. So I'll just finish it.
Yeah, okay.
And then they, just as they, and then he, and she's in the middle of saying something doesn't mean a darn thing, and he says, you've only got one earring on. What? What? You've only got one earring. Oh, for heaven's sake, right? And what is on your skirt? Why, that's terrible. Well, the waitress at the women's club, they dropped an eclair. I bet she dropped it in my chair. Oh, it's all dry. Well, didn't you notice it when you were getting dressed? No, I didn't. I didn't want to keep Jenny and Carl waiting. And just then, there's a honk. She's got to change her clothes now. You know, and keep the guy comes to the door. I mean, you're not ready yet? And they're bellyaching about him. But that's what happens.
Sure.
To us, you know,
well,
all the time.
You put a magnifying glass on a small incident.
I suppose so.
Sure.
Blow
and,
it up, you know.
And make it funny.
Yeah.
You have
and
the ability to find the
well,
humor.
Well, it isn't funny if your dishwasher overflows. It just isn't. I've had that happen. Or my laundry tub, something, a towel gets into the drain, and you come down to the kitchen to find there's 3 inches of water rushing out from the laundry room, you know.
Often it's not funny at
the time. No, it's not funny at the time.
Later
usually.
On, you look
That's
back
right.
and you find the humor
That's
in something
right.
like that.
Losing your diamond. Ring. I've written about 10,000 of these.
That many?
Yeah.
Well, how many have been broadcast?
I'm an elderly lady now.
Oh.
and I beg your pardon? What did you ask me?
How many have been broadcast?
All of them.
All of those were broadcast.
My God. Oh, yes. I am not counting the stuff in the wastebasket.
Well, when did you start performing yourself? Right from
always.
The beginning?
Mm-hmm.
So you were a writer slash actress at the same time, right?
I didn't know what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to write, and I knew I liked to act. And actually, the writing is the work.
Mm-hmm.
I learned this early at Minnesota. I learned it very early that nobody really cares about the writer. I've had people who are intelligent say to me, that's wonderful that you write Ethel. Who writes Albert? Really. It's unbelievable. Yeah. People really don't care. The past 10 years, to prove my theory, I've been asking people, you watch television? Oh, yeah, sure. I said, name me five writers.
Mm.
Five writers that have written television. Well, they ham and haw, and they usually can't think of anybody. Sometimes, once in a while, somebody who has an edge on the business will say Carl Reiner or Woody Allen as a gag writer, you know. But people don't pay any attention to the writer. And I realized writers always take such a back seat. Acting is fun. It really is. Mm-hmm. Acting is fun. And
well, you see, the truth of the matter is, I think, Peg, that you don't, the person listening to the work mm-hmm. or viewing the work is not supposed to be aware that it is written.
That is true. That is true. But look at the actors. Look at the accolades mm-hmm. that they take.
Oh,
the
yeah.
applause
yeah.
and the hands, you know.
Yeah.
And you'd think they wrote the lines.
Oh, yeah.
And the public treats them as though, isn't he clever, you know, that he was just spouting the lines the actor wrote. Writers get very little, they never get any respect. Not really. They get respect only in the fact that they get so mad they demand a hell of a lot of money.
Well, do you feel that...
In the movies. Yeah.
You feel that by being the actress mm-hmm. of and by performing your own work, you're getting the accolade then that...
Everybody needs mm-hmm. applause.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You would like to have somebody tell you they love you.
Surely.
Pat you on the
mm-hmm.
back and see that was a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think it encourages people, and I think in our business we get applause and we get things. Oh, in the business you might be known, you know,
mm-hmm.
they'll give you some respect mm-hmm. as a writer, but the average person that isn't necessarily that you're demanding respect of the public, you just like to have them think, oh, this was written, it isn't this, you know?
You know,
Bob Hope didn't make up all these jokes.
No, but Bob Hope rarely gave credit to his writers.
Didn't he?
Rarely gave.
Oh, really?
Jack Benny always talked about his writers or he did sketches with the writers. What about them?
Yeah.
But Bob... You never were aware of, and he had one of the largest writing gangs in the.
Well, writers are unsung heroes; they truly are, and they're treated so badly, especially mm-hmm. in television and radio. The writers were treated like garbage, paid any attention.
Well, when you were getting your first salaries there, and mm-hmm. you wouldn't get that $5 raise.
I got 50. Listen, I worked 7 years at a small radio mm-hmm. station mm-hmm. before I got to New York. I never got more than $20 a week,
mm-hmm.
and even though this was in the 40s. Other stations, like the bigger stations, these are 250 watt mm-hmm. stations. I mean, they were paid a lot more than that. I can tell. Mm-hmm. I have no business head, probably because I had no father to teach me, and my mother didn't believe in checkbooks. Mm-hmm. You had money. It's the only way you could buy something. You didn't charge, and you didn't lay away nothing like that. Probably wisely, mm-hmm. and to save something. I saved something, even if it's a dollar out of everything I made. And... What are we talking about?
Well,
looking
we're
over
talking,
there to think.
Talk about
see,
the credit.
Carly's there now. I've got to go to her.
Credits
what?
For write, about
what?
The writing credits. But well, how did you get to New York? What got you to New York?
It really isn't.
Did you have a job opportunity there?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I've met somebody who I don't honestly know how I met, how this person knew about me, and suggested. Was through somebody, but I really, truly, I've got to think back because I really don't remember. But I wrote a script that was based on Rose Franken's Claudia,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote it, and then I guess I went to my head. They paid me $350, and I just thought I've had this. So I went up to New York, and this other fellow that I met, Bob Cotton, I didn't know him at all, and he liked the show, and later produced the radio one, and he took it to NBC. And they voted to put it on the air at once, but they wanted to own it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's the only thing I've got. And I wouldn't sell it. So a man named Louis Titterton just then quit his job. He was on the board and with NBC. And he went to an agency. And he called the president of the Blue Network. And he said, NBC just lost a show that I think you ought to have. NBC had two networks, the red and the mm-hmm. blue. And they were forced to sell the blue. And they sold it to Ed Noble. Who owned Lifesaver, mm-hmm. Ben Menefel. And he was not going to have soap operas. This was going to be a real classy network. Chamber music mm-hmm. and orchestras and great dramas. Mm-hmm. Well, you know how long that would have lasted. So I came, really, I was here. And I always say that it has, get me back on the track again about how what happened.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't so much talent in this business. People are all, young writers and young actors are always saying, what did you do? They don't really want to know what I did. They want to know what mistakes I made, so they don't make the same ones. Mm-hmm. You know, which is true. It's logical. It isn't so much talent, because there's a lot of talented people haven't gotten anywhere. It's timing, over which you have no control. You go in to see a man about a job. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's had a fight with his wife. Maybe his stomach is upset. He's been up all night in the bathroom. He feels rotten. And he's not really listening to your patter. You know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or if he's in a good mood and some girl has just said, I love you, and he's got a date for dinner, and he's on your side right away. Yeah, you see? Mm-hmm. Now, it makes a difference. Well, I'd like to think this is it at any rate. I do not think, if I had not had 7 years at small radio stations, mm-hmm. writing all these shows, because I wrote, oh, well, let's face it, 7 years, you figure that's 6 days, 7 days a week, because we always worked.
Yeah.
And writing stuff in the thousands. I don't think, if I hadn't had the experience, I wouldn't have lasted at the network. When you get the break, you've got to be able to keep it. And I went in. What happened, I just got an apartment after looking all over the place. I paid $40 a month in Cumberland. I thought, ooh, I'm getting to the network. Well, I'm getting up to New York. They're probably going to charge more for rent. I figured maybe they'd charge 50 or 60 a month. First, I looked at a place. Cheapest place I looked at was down in south of Washington Square in New York. And it was called the Cobra Nightclub, and it was a strip joint, which I'd never heard of. And it stayed open all night playing this terrible music. And I looked at the apartment for which they wanted $80. Mm. And the kitchen was a little door that opened and there was one hot plate in there filled with dead scrambled eggs. Oh, it was filled with little kind of roaches, which I didn't. And the curtains were hanging down. They were ripped. And the upholstered sofa was oozing out. The stuffing was oozing out. And the fireplace had orange peels and eggshells. Oh, God. So, of course, I was beginning to get a little panicked because I only had the $300
for
that one uh-huh. script. And then also some money that I'd saved, which mm-hmm. was, I think I had about $500. To amuse it, how little I knew about banking. When I went in to draw my money, I said, well, we can't get it right now. You have to have a little notice. Take out all your savings. I said, well, $500 was a lot of money to me. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, can't you just go in the back and take it out mm-hmm. of the box? She said, what? And I thought that when you had a savings account at a bank that you had a little box with your name on it in the bank.
Put the money
you
in there.
Put the cash in and brought it out. My education has been sad and neglected on a few stops. So then, coming to New York, I found this apartment, Gramercy Park. It was in the paper. I got it for $110 a month. Mm. Beautiful, lovely, one big room, long bedroom, L-shaped kitchen, two walk-in closets, and another. It was furnished. I couldn't get a phone because it was wartime, and my radio didn't work that I brought up from Cumberland. And it was AC, it was DC, and I should have had AC or vice versa. I can't remember which. I didn't know about it, so I didn't know why it didn't work. And so they couldn't reach me. So I got a telegram from American Broadcasting mm-hmm. Company. It said, "We hear you have a show that we'd like to hear. Would you please call me, Philip Carlin, President, American mm-hmm. Broadcasting Company?" Well, I think back now. I just, well, that was nice of him. I didn't have any money. I'd gone down and they had shortchanged me at the place, and I'd spent some. I'd given them a 10, and they gave me change for a 1, and then I had to buy something, you know. Mm. Oh, I tell you, they saw me coming practically everywhere. And so I went down to the drugstore, and I didn't know the man. This is on the corner of Park Avenue, 4th Avenue and 20th, Gramercy Park. And I said to the drug, brought the telegram along, and I said, I was wondering, would you trust me for a dime? I live around the corner, and I showed him the telegram, and I said, it really should make me so sweet. He said, well, certainly you'll have a dime. Then he kind of stood beside me, and I go, what did he say? What did he say? You know, I said, well, he said he wanted mm-hmm. the dime to go up there and talk to him, which I did, and then there seemed to be no problem. He said, well, we're going to hold auditions. I like the show. Complete each day. That was the whole thing.
That was Ethel and Albert.
It was not a soap opera, and that's what they wanted. So I really and truly think if they hadn't had to split the network, I would never have made it.
Oh, sure really. You would have.
Well,
oh, yeah.
You can't tell.
Maybe not at that moment, but
you know something?
Talent.
We went on the air April 17th, 2 months later, and you know that for almost 5 years I was a little ashamed that I'd been in New York for 2 months and hadn't gotten a job.
Oh, my gosh. Now, Richard Widmark was the first Albert,
he was
Albert,
the first
right?
Albert,
was he
yeah.
on staff at ABC?
No,
or
no, no, no. He was playing Front Page Pharaoh and something else, and he didn't like radio. And he, like most of the male actors, wanted to go on the stage and then on to Hollywood, which he did. And he left me. I didn't think he was very nice. He got up and walked out on the very first show we did. Before I'd even finished, I had the last speech. He put on his hat and walked out.
Before the script was finished?
And then on a Friday, and he was told that since this was a two-person thing, that he really couldn't go off doing other shows, you know, that this had to stick to this pretty much. And he came to me on a Friday afternoon and said, I won't be here on Monday. I'm going into a play. And the network was fearful. What, 2 days? Were you going to audition and get somebody in 2 days, you know? The network's furious that he had to stay for another week. And that's when I got Alan. And the play was Trio, which was about lesbians. And it closed the first night that it opened. And New York wasn't ready for lesbians in 1944.
But
and I got Alan, and I worked with him for 20 years.
Yeah,
No, he went into television.
He was absolutely perfect for that role.
Took him 8 months.
Eight months to get into it.
All actors were all used. I didn't know any better. I didn't know how to do what they were doing. But I can remember the lines from my very first script. And Ethel and I were entertaining, and she says, and he comes home and says, "Did you bring home the salted nuts?" And he says, "What salted nuts?" He says, "The last thing I said is, we're going to bring home the salted nuts." Well, these lovely actors, I told them I didn't want to play it because I didn't want to be rejected, and told them my voice wasn't as sexy the way, or, you know, like that. And when they would audition, sometimes there wouldn't be any girls there, and they'd say, "Peg, get out and read with him." I was so flabbergasted at the very beginning, and I'd hear that they were doing the script like this. Albert comes in the door, and Ethel says, "Did you bring home the salted nuts?" Pause. "What salted nuts?" "It was the last thing I said to you this morning. Bring home the salted nuts." And I'd say, "Can't they read it the way people talk? You know, a little faster." And they didn't know what I was talking about. I know they thought they were nice to me because I was the writer. And boy, the actors are always nice to the writers. You know? They want the job. And I told Phil Carlton that I didn't want to write to play it. Then, of course, you always want something. You always want the one that got away.
Yeah.
And he said, "What do you mean you don't want to play it? You've always done it." I said, "Well, I just this thought it'd be better if I just wrote." "No, well, all right, whatever you say. But we're going to number everybody, and the numbers that win will play it." So then he pretended that I had won, and Richard Widmark, whom they wanted. And number 17 and number 32 or whatever it was had won, and that's how I played it.
One of the
very clever of me, but I didn't plan it.
Well. One of the beautiful things about the show was that you were playing Ethel, and you were delivering the words that you wrote yourself.
Right,
so it became so natural.
Yes.
And one of the beautiful things also about the show is that it is delivered so naturally.
It takes a bit of doing.
Absolutely.
You know.
Well, I believe that, you know, some would say you're stepping on each other's lines. But it's natural conversation for someone to start talking before the other one is finished and that sort of thing.
I can give you a very good example of this. Just the only other thing I've done was Jess Oppenheimer, who did Lucy, produced Lucy, wanted me for a big spectacular. It was General Motors' 50th anniversary, something like that, or 25th, whatever it was, I don't know, 25th, I suppose. And I did, they were all big stars. I was the only one that wasn't really a crack big shot. I mean, Helen Hayes, Harold Burnett, Abdul Allison, Kirk Douglas, Claudette Colbert, Cyril Richard, they were Eddie Bracken, they were all big. And he got me, to do a husband and wife sketch with Don Ameche, who detested me, apparently. He never spoke to me. Never spoke to me when we rehearsed. He never said good morning to anybody. We didn't know what to make of him. And when time came and we went to this was a rehearsal in New York, when we got out to the Brooklyn studios, upstaged me all the time, even on television. And Cyril Richard, whom I didn't know at all, sidled up to me and he said, "Don't let him do this to you. He's standing in front of you on every single one of your speeches." Well, I thought, isn't that funny? They don't know that in the control room, but they didn't. They said, "Mr. Ameche, would you mind not standing in front of Miss Lynch? I'm standing exactly on my marks." It was very nasty to everybody. So he was just mad he was doing it with me. He would have liked to have had the sketch done with Claudette Colbert.
Oh, you see, he was mad
that he wasn't a big star he was working with, obviously. But he could just, Oppenheimer, I know, he told me, because of this byplay between them, and Amici couldn't handle it. You see, he was used to doing movies, though he used to do radio, but well, they didn't do that overlapping. Don't you see?
Yeah. No,
they didn't
do
any of that. Mm-hmm. You didn't step on anybody else's lines.
Right,
you'd have been slobbered, you know?
But see, that was how natural this was.
That's right. Yeah.
You've had a wonderful career, and you've contributed so much to the happiness of the people who listen to Ethel and Albert on the radio. I want to thank you for that and for all the work you did.
Thank you.
And what have you done with all these scripts? You got them
They're taking over the living room now from my office, and I got myself a computer. Because I was getting my Selectric 3 fixed, and I've hated the Correcto type, and I got the man out there, and I said, "Now I have some ideas for IBM, and I want to tell you, when they make their Selectric 4, I think this should be changed, and that should be changed." And, Peg, just a minute. I want to tell you something. Then IBM isn't making any more typewriters, and I said, "Not making any more typewriters?" And he said, "Well, it's worse than that. They're not making any more typewriter repairmen." So I got a writer friend of mine to go and get a computer. But it's very complicated. I got a pack of delegates or something, and it's not 95 Windows, and I don't think about it. I learned how to play solitaire very quickly that weekend. When he left, he said, "I think you better start learning how to type your scripts on it. After all, you've been handed a $3,000 deck of cards." You better...
You're a wonderful lady. Thank you
so much
for this time. I appreciate it very much.
Sure.
God bless you.
Thank you, dear.